Good morning. If anybody here did not receive the sheet in advance, that means one of two things is happening. Either you're not on my email list yet, or it means that that your spam blocker is overzealous, from my perspective at any rate. But if you would like to receive the sheets in advance and the follow-up on the classes with the links for the audio, please make sure to see me afterwards or to see Loretta, and that way I will know to include you. We're still wrapping up the topic from last week. I hope people saw the email and made sure to bring the sheets from last time. Our topic last time was censorship of Jewish texts, and as we were just talking about, it was very odd to leave class and to turn on the radio and hear about what was going on, and in Paris, of all places, after our conversation about the burning of the Talmud in Paris, just added another surreal dimension to it. But we gave the early chronology, talked about how censorship by the church began as a fight against heresy, and Jews were really a minor part of it, and really not involved at all at the outset. But when, at the end of the Dark Ages, there's a revival of censorship, it's very much targeted at the Jewish community, not solely, again, but there's a major push in that direction. We talked about Peter of Cluny and his investigations of the Talmud. We talked about factors that contributed to the restarting of the censorship that brought us into the 13th century and the burning of the Talmud in Paris. I sent out the link after class last week to the paper by Sadia Eisenberg on the burning of the Talmud not on the one in Paris in 1240, but of... His was on... Not about 1240. His was on... Rabbi Yechiel of Paris in 1240. I'm mixing up 1240 and 1263. Sorry. His was on the burning in Paris in 1240, and then we talked about the 1263 one with Nachmanides and that debate. It brought us all the way through to the 16th century. And what I wanted to do now that we've understood the roots of the censorship, what they were trying to do, and some of the history, let's talk about the mechanics and how it was actually accomplished. So over time, the church needed to develop new methods of censorship. We already talked about the problems that they had when they were operating through the secular government, and the secular government wasn't necessarily interested in carrying it out. But the methods in general of confiscating Jewish texts and destroying them were fairly limited for two reasons. First of all, because Jews would hide their books. They would put the books in the roots of trees. They would put the books in old wells. Jews hang out with wells in those days probably wasn't a good idea because that tended to lead to other problems, the accusations about the Jews and the wells. Another reason why it didn't work, interestingly, was because the Christians found a good market for secondhand books. What the Jews would do is to save the books, they would give them to their Christian neighbors, who, after the danger was gone, would not necessarily give them back, but would then sell them to other people. But either way, the church ends up thwarted because the books are still in circulation. Also, over time, especially as you hit the 16th century, there's a liberalization within Europe, and people frown on these harsher old methods of simply taking away the books and throwing them in a wagon and burning the wagon in the town square. And so they need to come up with new ways to do it. And this begins in early 16th century Italy. It continues really as an Italian thing until the 17th century when it spreads elsewhere. And this is what we called last week expurgation. Expurgation was a method which Jews felt they could tolerate more, and they didn't feel driven to extremes to avoid it. It's sort of, you exert enough pressure that you can get what you want, but that the recipient, the person on the receiving end of the pressure, doesn't feel like they have to change things. And the mechanics of expurgation were the following. They would go to a town, and they would declare, they meaning whichever branch of the church was responsible for this, the Dominicans, the Franciscans, whoever it was, they would declare that all Jews within the town would have to submit their books to censors. The censors would give you a receipt, so you'd have your ticket to be able to get your books back. And then the censors were responsible to get rid of whatever they found troubling within the book. their methods depended on who the censors were. So some of them erased, but erasing things is tedious, right? You're not dealing with pencil. You're dealing with ink. So often they would just blot out the text they didn't like. Quite a few of them would use a fine brush, so they would just cover a word, but some would use a big brush, and you can see this, like the text still exists, you can see how this was done, and they would just blot out, you know, a page or a large chunk of a page. Yeah.
My father used to collect ink pencils.
Really?
And quite a few of them are exactly what you're describing, blacked out, often with the name of the priest or the monk who did it in the origin.
Right, we have to sign your artwork. No, that was actually to say this was censored properly, right? So, right, incunabula is the term for the books that were produced in the early days. But the censors would indeed sign a page. They would sign at the end of the book. They would sign on the spot. They would make their mark. There were careless ones who would just do a few lines through a passage. You know, not actually blot out the text so you could read it. Rarely they would actually cut out a page or part of a page, or they would paste paper over it so you just couldn't, you know, read that spot. So all sorts of different methods in use. It's not really legislated. The church doesn't care. What they care about is that you're not reading it.
Yeah.
So that goes back to our point last week. They were looking for heresy, and they defined heresy as that which opposed Christian teachings, that which said things they felt were bad about Christians, that which they felt, not imposed, but elevated the authority of the rabbis over what they felt was their reading of a biblical text. That's what they wanted to get rid of. Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, when I get a book back and the line is missing, that's the line I want to read. Yeah, no, that's true. And Jews actually aided in this, in compilation of the index of passages that would be expurgated, because the censors, as I said last week, often couldn't read Hebrew. So eventually they actually created something called the College of Neophytes, which were Jews who had converted to Christianity. So they were neophytes in terms of Christianity. They were experts in terms of, or not experts necessarily, but they were more learned in terms of Judaism, and they could offer counsel to the church. They compiled what was called a Sefer HaZikuk. Sefer HaZikuk was a collection of specific passages and words that had to be eliminated, as well as rules for deciding what to eliminate and how to eliminate. It was written between the years of 1594 and 1596 by a Jew who had converted to Christianity, name being, I hope I pronounce it correctly, Domenico Erosolimitano. That was his name. Don't worry, you don't have to write it down. It won't be on the test. But copies of this still exist, including one that is written in his handwriting. We're now ahead enough in history that you could actually have documents like this around on your sheets. If you take a look at source number 9, I gave you some of the rules that were presented in this Sefer HaZikuk, along with a website where you can find more of it. So, reading from there, any place in the Bible where debate and difference exists between the Jewish faith and ours, if there is an explicit challenge to our understanding, or if it brings a proof for the Jewish view, even if the names of Christian scholars are not mentioned openly, the entire matter must be erased. But if the matter is explained according to their opinion, but without a challenge to our faith, then it is no matter. So you could have a text that explains a biblical verse our way, but doesn't mention that the church has a different point of view, and that will survive. But if it mentions that the church has another way to look at it and it disagrees, that's no good. That has to be expurgated. Any instance of an insult against a law of the laws of our faith, or our teachings, or any custom or practice, or an insult toward a king, officer, or one of the holy priests of our nation should be entirely erased. Any place that mentions something which is a great heresy, such as transmigration of souls, and what they're talking about is Gilgul, an idea that we discussed a few years ago, the idea that people come back in another body. The church was not a fan of the idea, considered it heresy. Or the idea that all souls were created during the 6 days of creation, or that God cries, or that the souls of the wicked are turned into demons, Shadim and Mazikin, as we have here in parentheses, or that the evil spirits which possess people are the souls of the wicked deceased and the like, the entire thing should be erased. Not because it spoke even against Christianity, but because they felt it was wrong, And they felt it was foolish. And if you remember, you go back to Peter. Peter says, all these Jewish ideas, by the way, some of the ideas here in number 10 are not Jewish at all. Yeah, no, some of them are not ours. Nonetheless, these are ideas that are current in European society that they feel are damaging to people's reason and keeping them from accepting the church. Yes, Stephen?
I take it that nothing from the Tanakh or the Talmud was erased.
Why do you say that?
Well, I don't know. You said.
No, absolutely. We mentioned it a little bit last time. They absolutely erased sections from the Talmud. Yeah.
The Tanakh.
Well, Tanakh, no, commentary to Tanakh, but not Tanakh itself. That's right. That would fall to the Muslims, and when they would change it in the Quran, they didn't like some of the things that we had with it, and felt that we had it wrong. That you're familiar with. Like for example, the binding of Isaac, right? The Akedah was the binding of Ishmael, right? Those sorts of things. Any places that mention Edom or Rome or Italy in a negative sense should be erased, because these were all representative of the church. Any place that mentions that God is pained over the loss of Israel should be erased. Any place which mentions men who died for their faith, such as those who died in Portugal and Spain, if it is mentioned that they died sanctifying God's name, Kiddush Hashem, or if they are called by the name holy or righteous, Kiddushim, Tzadikim, that should be completely erased, because you're praising the people who refuse to convert. Any place that mentions festivals, holidays, or celebrations of ours in an insulting way, such as Lifnei Edehem and the like, and what they're talking about there is a chapter of the Talmud, the opening chapter of a volume called Avodah Zarah, which deals with the question of whether a Jew is allowed to do business with a non-Jew in the days surrounding his holiday. The concern was that if the Jew does business with the non-Jew, then he is going to feel like he had some kind of windfall gift, and he'll go into his, whatever it is, house of worship on his holiday and thank his God for it. So there were prohibitions against engaging in certain types of business before the holiday, or selling them the things they would use within the rituals of the holiday was also considered problematic. So they don't like that chapter, as you might imagine. Even though the truth of the matter is, the chapter is not Christian specific. It's a statement about anything that is outside of the sphere of Judaism. Nonetheless, again, going back to our point last time about the years when the Talmud is being written and how Christianity is such a rising and growing force at that point, there's no question that it's absolutely on the minds of the Jews of the day when the Talmud is in fact being canonized. So that's out. Actually, the rest of the line. Or if it says it is prohibited for an Israelite to transact business with them on those days, that should be erased. So you have this set of rules, and you can see I only excerpted a little bit of it, for how they are to deal with these Jewish texts. You know, originally the Jews were opposed to it, but they came to actually want it, because it was considered to be the least bad option. And the Jews would actually end up paying the censors who did this. So you had to pay them to take your book. Yeah. Wait. Sorry. Yes.
Can we go back to number 10? Excuse
yeah.
me.
Yeah, sure.
It was mentioned that some of these things here are not Jewish.
Yeah.
But isn't everything here found somewhere within Jewish folklore, within Jewish writing? Isn't everything, even the Divic, everything exists within Judaism here?
So you're asking a really good question, which I think it's a broader point of what is Judaism. Someone showed me a couple of months ago a book that came out of Customs of the Jews, and he was shocked by some of the things that he saw in there. He's like, this doesn't look at all like anything Jewish to him. And I tried to explain to him, the fact that Jews did something doesn't mean it's a Jewish custom. That means there were Jews who did something. So if Jews in a particular town had neighbors who did something and the Jews picked it up, that doesn't make it Jewish. In order for it to be Jewish, it has to be somehow, well, I'll do one better. Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz was a rabbi in Chicago was he in Toronto at some point? Somebody's reminding me of that. I don't know. He was in Chicago primarily, certainly, 1950s, 1960s, 70s. and a very interesting thinker. And he wrote an essay, which is very worth reading, called What is a Jewish Philosophy? And the question he was trying to address is, if a Jew writes something of philosophy, so let's say Spinoza writes something, is that automatically Jewish philosophy? Because a Jew wrote a work of philosophy. On the other hand, if a non-Jew writes something, but it's about Judaism, let's say Kierkegaard writes Fear and Trembling, right? Is that Jewish philosophy? Because it's about Judaism. And he comes up with his sort of way to deal with it. He feels that there are certain fundamental elements of Judaism without which something simply isn't Jewish. So his particular set, if I remember correctly, and it's a while since I looked at the essay, but his particular set is the nature of the Jewish people as a people associated with God. That has to be part of it in order for it to be Jewish. The acceptance of Torah at Sinai is a second element, and the nature of God, although I don't know what that means, is the third element. And those are the three things which you have to have in order for it to be Jewish. Anything that eliminates one of those isn't Jewish. Now, that won't necessarily address the question Loretta is raising, because you could write an essay about Dybbuk's without ever touching on any of the three. Yeah. So is that a Jewish thing or not? So it's all really, I think, a matter of how you... Well, I'm going to go back to what we did a few years back, right? We had a series here, two series here, actually, in this room, on the supernatural. And we went through some of these ideas. We talked about reincarnation. We talked about the Dybbuk as examples. And we tried to show what the Jewish roots were from which this idea could have been absorbed into and accepted into Judaism. So we talked about, for example, the fact that there's a biblical verse in which Abigail, one of the wives of King David, gives him a blessing in which she says that his soul should... She says that his soul should be bound up in the bond of life with God, a blessing which is still used today, actually, at funerals. Tien ishmas ha-tzuro b'tzorach hayim, the soul should be bound up in the bond of life. If you ever go to a Jewish cemetery and see on the headstones the letters Taf, Nun, Tzadi, Bet, Hey, that's an acronym for this blessing. And it's often written on headstones. But that's part of the blessing. And then the other part of the blessing is that the souls of his enemies should be cast about in the palm of, or the bowl of, the sling. Suggesting that she's saying that the souls of his enemies should have to go through some kind of punishment, being catapulted in some way after their death. And the question, of course, is, well, what exactly does that mean? And the answer, of course, is, I don't know. But from there, ideas of limbo, or ideas of the soul having to travel different places, find a root. So there are, you know, there are roots of things that I would say are in recognized canon, meaning biblical text, meaning Talmud. But then they go off in all sorts of other directions. And the question of, is this Jewish or is it not Jewish, remains a really good question. The Dybbuk we will find in traditional writing of the 18th, 19th century, but you won't find it much before that. Possession. I think we had mentioned when we did the Supernatural series, Bishop Oregon, writing 3rd, 4th century, maybe 5th. He's early. So Bishop Oregon writes about methods of... blanking on the word, exorcising demons and ending possessions, and he has methods that he says come from the Jews. And there's a Greek writer who says, this is what Solomon did. Did they know what they were talking about? I don't know. But my point in saying all of this is only that I don't know what to call Jewish or not Jewish within this paragraph. Certainly the idea that when people die, their souls become shedim or mazikin, become demons of some kind, is not one I can associate with anything that I have seen in Jewish tradition. But who knows? You know, maybe there is somebody somewhere, but he'd have to, you know, provide it with a root in a serious text in order for me to really trust it as something Jewish. What other ones were in that line? Reincarnation, we discussed, is a great debate. whether that's actually a Jewish idea or something external, with serious voices on both sides. The idea of God crying, I mean, we find God being upset in the biblical text. I'm not sure what exactly has them about crying, why that's something that disturbs them.
Crying about the loss of Israel.
Well, in the line number 10, I'm looking at, in source number 9, the line that they have, rule number 10, is just where that God cries.
Oh, right.
So I'm not sure. You're talking about number 12, God is pained over the loss of Israel.
Yeah.
Maybe it bothers them simply because it seems to offend the idea of God as an omniscient God, and therefore he knew everything in advance, and how can he be upset when something happens, and so on. Maybe that's what offends them, anthropomorphism regarding God. I don't know.
Or maybe crying seems to be a sign of weakness.
Maybe. Sign of weakness. Could be.
I have another question. What's the difference between blasphemy and heresy?
The difference between blasphemy and heresy. Blasphemy, as I suppose it's all how you use the word, but I'm going to take it from a Jewish context. There is a term in Hebrew called megadeth, which would be used for somebody who cursed God, who said something negative towards God, not just about, but towards. Blasphemy is an attack. Whereas heresy would be belief in something which we think is wrong. You know, but fundamentally wrong. I mean, that's a whole other discussion, is what qualifies as heresy? Is every mistake heresy, and so on? But that would be the distinction, I think. Blasphemy tends to be viewed more as an attack, whereas heresy is an idea. So there's the element of contempt and lack of reverence. It's personal. Blasphemy is personal. Yeah. But not all philosophy is heresy. Okay. So we're going to actually come back to expurgation a little bit more, because we're going to talk about the roles that Jews played within this expurgation in a little bit. But there's also comic relief that comes about with this, especially when you get into more modern censorship. And my favorite is 19th century Russian censorship. Yes, it was still going on in the 19th century. Sorry? No, but of Jewish texts specifically, and confiscating Jewish texts and altering them. So I'm going to give you a few examples. One, the Book of Exodus. So in a guide that they had for censorship, there's a guide that had to deal with the Book of Shemot of Exodus, which has within it, Exodus has a particular section which deals with civil law. And it has 11 different notations in it, 11 different spots where you're supposed to write over it, these laws are invalid today, in order to produce a Book of Exodus. Anybody here ever hear the term kitnios or kitniot?
Yes.
Okay. So kitniot or kitnios, it's a term that literally comes from a word meaning beans. Beans or legumes. Without getting into a huge discussion, because really I'm just using this for one minor point that I find funny. You know that there's a biblical prohibition against eating chametz, leaven, on Passover. And chametz means specifically the five grains. What those grains are is subject to some discussion, but let's call them wheat, barley, rye, oats, and spelt. Eating them if they've been exposed to water and they've had a chance to rise. That's it. That's all that's going to be off limits. However, a custom developed in Ashkenazic communities going back over a range of time between 600 and 800 years ago of avoiding certain other items which come under the heading of kitnios, either because they tended to be harvested and processed along with the grains, and so grain would get mixed in, or because they harvested and processed it in the same way as the grains, and they produced things that looked like the grain products, and there was concern for confusion, or a couple of other things along the way. This isn't the class about kitnios. My point only is that when rabbinic texts talk about it, they will identify something as min kitnios. Min kitniot. Min, meaning species. No, mem yudnun. Mem nun would be from. But mem yudnun means a species, a kind of thing. So min kitniot means this is a species of kitniot. You follow? The problem is that the word min was also used in rabbinic texts to mean a heretic. So when the word min shows up, the Russian censors think we're talking about the church. So they say, you can't do that. All appearances of the word min have to be changed to akum, which is an acronym meaning worshiper of the stars, which means that texts about the laws of Passover have within them akum kitnios, worshiper of the stars, legumes. And it just makes no sense, but hey, you know, that's the way it goes. So that was another example. And then the third and last example that I'm going to bring is source number 10. On your source number 10 on your sheets, because this one I get a kick out of. Yeah, the old sheet, the sheet from last week still. The Russians fought a war with the Turks in the first half of the 19th century, and they decided to take advantage, I suppose, of the opportunity to say that wherever the word goy appeared in a Jewish text, you had to replace it with Turk. Now, the problem is that the word goy is actually not a derogatory word in its origin. It simply means nation. And not only that, but it often means Jewish nation. So you have biblical text that says, Umi goy gadol asher lo Elokim krovim elav, who is a great nation like us, that we have God being close to us. The word goy means the Jews. And there's a particular prayer called Tachanun, which is recited daily, twice daily actually, in which we ask God, as part of it, Shomer Goy Kadosh, Shmor She'erit Am Kadosh, Ve'al Yovad Goy Kadosh. The line means, the guardian of the holy nation, Shomer Goy Kadosh, guardian of the holy nation, please protect the remnant of the holy nation, and don't let the holy nation be destroyed. So, the Russians insist that you have to replace every iteration of the word Goy with Turk. And so you get source number 10. Guardian of the Holy Turk, guard the remnant of the Holy Turk, let not the Holy Turk be destroyed. Go figure.
Nobody figured it out.
I imagine the Jews got a good laugh every time they said that. But that's it. I mean, these exist. This isn't just like hypothetical. This was actually, like, we have these. The roles that Jews played in this, and this is the last part of this topic. So there's a legend which has a certain appeal, that Jews were actually the ones who caused, indirectly, the burning of the Talmud in Paris, which we talked about last week. You see, Maimonides, in his day, so we'll run back further, the 810th yard site of Maimonides having just been this past week, but Maimonides was controversial in his day for several different reasons. One reason being his heavy use of Aristotelian thought, another being his approach to codifying Jewish law and supplanting earlier texts with his own, a third being certain ideas that he promoted, philosophical ideas, that others disagreed with strongly. And the legend goes that those who opposed him, well, the fact is that those who opposed him wanted to ban his books. That's fact. Another fact is they lost. But the legend is that they went to the church to get them to investigate and ban the writings of Maimonides. And that this then led to the church opening the investigation and saying, well, let's investigate the Talmud while we're at it, and that leads to the burning. And it has certain appeal to it because it sort of feels like, you know, a moral lesson, like, look what happens when you do things like that. It also fits Jewish history because, quite frankly, we do have a history of bringing our enemies upon ourselves. That happened. So, for example, you had within Roman times, when the Second Temple still stood, a battle among Jews for political control of the Jewish kingdom, and one side brought in the Romans to help them, and that ended up being catastrophic. Like, we have a history of doing things like this. But take a look at source number 11, where Dr. Sadia Eisenberg investigates this and debunks it. He says, in 1232 or 1233, anti-Maimonists in Montpellier handed the more philosophical books of Maimonides over to local friars present to eradicate heresy. The mendicants, that's the monks themselves, then burned these texts. The papal court's interest in rabbinic texts boded ill for the Jews, and this precedent made it all the easier for Gregory, Pope Gregory IX, to take a jaundiced view of the Talmud a few years later. According to Yitzhak Baer, the historian, the 1240 debate was at least in part an outgrowth of earlier inquisitorial activities. That's the theory. However, the connection between the Maimonidean controversy and the 1240 debate is far from clear. In all the papal literature surrounding the 1240 debate and the subsequent burning of the Talmuds, Talmuds plural, Jerusalem and Babylonian, the earlier burning of Maimonidean books goes unmentioned. Association between the two Jewish book burnings is largely absent in contemporary Jewish literature as well. Three separate works, all written in response to the debate and the subsequent burning of rabbinic texts, fail to mention the Maimonidean controversy or to connect it with the burning of the Talmuds. In fact, only one source supports the relationship between the Maimonidean controversy in southern France and the Paris debate and ultimate destruction of hundreds of Talmud manuscripts. Writing some 50 years after the burning of the Talmud or thereabouts, the pro-Maimonist Rabbi Hillel of Verona writes that, quote, 40 days did not pass from the burning of Maimonides' works until that of the Talmud. And the ashes of the Talmud were mixed with those of... And he adds in brackets an explanation, Maimonides' overly philosophical works, which were handed over to the ecclesiastical authorities, Guide for the Perplexed and the Book of Knowledge, since there is still ash at the site. So Rabbi Hillel of Verona, writing 50 years after the Talmud has been burned, claims the connection. Now, before we read the next paragraph, so the speed readers should not answer this, why would he want to make this connection? Why would Rabbi Hillel of Verona, supporter of Maimonides, want to make this connection?
Because he is a supporter.
Right, because he wants to say...
Right.
Well, he wants to say, look what happened. You burned Maimonides' books, and look at the result. Right? He wants to say, chickens are coming home to roost. That's what he would like to be able to say. Given the tendentious nature of this source, Baer's claim that the Maimonidean controversy set a precedent for subjecting rabbinical texts to inquisitorial authorities in 1240 is highly tenuous. Hillel's immediate pro-Maimonidean bias aside, there are historical issues of concern here as well, matters of time and place. It was not 40 days, but approximately 10 years between the confiscation of Maimonides' writings and the burning of the Talmud. Furthermore, Hillel's vivid and evocative imagery of the mixing of the ashes of Maimonidean and Talmudic books notwithstanding, his words in no way comport with the facts. Maimonides' writing was burned in Montpellier, the Talmud in front of the Church of Notre Dame. Doubtless Hillel was aware of these discrepancies and chose to connect the two burnings for rhetorical purposes. Hillel's letter cannot be taken at face value, as Baer would have it. So that idea that the two events are connected and the Jews actually triggered this is within this record, and there is some discussion about it, but I think overall it's generally understood that that's fairly weak. Nonetheless, Jews were involved. We've already seen quite a few converted Jews who were involved in the process of either calling Jewish books to the attention of the church or actively being involved in guiding the censorship. Jews, as I mentioned before, funded the expurgation willingly. But more than that, Jews developed a system of self-censorship. They became self-censors in order to avoid worse from the church. So communities do it. Jews of Milan agreed in the year 1550 to avoid the burning of their books that they would simply get rid of things themselves. The printing presses did it. Gershom of Sansino, at the end of the 15th century, early days of the printing press, he publishes the Talmud. He omits the passages that have been censored from the manuscripts he was using. In other words, whatever the church didn't want, he says, let me exclude it now, rather than get myself in trouble and cause them to burn my manuscript. He did leave spaces to note that there was omission. But over time, he actually expanded that which was gone. The Steinsaltz edition of the Talmud today has gone to great lengths to introduce back into the text those passages that had been removed. But you will still find Talmud volumes today that are printed without those sections that had been removed. So the printing presses do it. On June 21st, 1554, On June 21st, 1554, there was a decision made by a Jewish community. I think this was in Italy, but I'm not sure. I'm looking at my notes now, and it's not clear to me. that they would require a 3-member rabbinical court in order to publish a book. Meaning, we are going to have to pass any manuscripts by a rabbinical court in order for them to approve a text for publication. You would also need the leader of the local Jewish community, or if it's a small area, the nearest large community, to approve it. And that led to the development of something called a haskama. Anybody familiar with the Hebrew word haskama? Right. Haskama literally is an agreement. That's exactly what it is, literally. A haskama today means something very different from what it once meant. The haskama's approbation is a kind way to understand what a haskama is today. Meaning that what you'll see today is often a Jewish text will come out with a letter in the front of it, or a series of letters in the front of it, letters of approbation, which 50 years ago, the letter said, I have read this book, I think it's wonderful, I think it teaches X, Y, and Z, and therefore people should like this book. However, there's been an evolution of that, largely because printing has become so easy for people, and there's been this incredible burst of Jewish publication. I'm going to say that that's why this has happened. But the letters went from that to, I have read part of this book, and I think in general it's probably pretty good, to now, I know the author, and the author is a good person. I haven't actually read the book, but, you know, so the Haskama has evolved even within the last 50 years. But what the Haskama was originally was literally, as Loretta said, an agreement. It was an approval of the book for publication. It begins, the first time, I believe, is in 1560 on a Polish edition of the Talmud. That was what that was. Now, the truth of the matter is, there actually is a version of the Haskama that's even older, but that's going to be in the second half of our class today. So, there's another aspect to Haskama. In Poland in 1631, just continuing the theme of Jews being involved in censorship, the rabbi sent out a letter. The letter ordered them to omit any reference to the Savior of Christianity in any editions of the Talmud, and to leave a space with a circle. That would be a circle there. And as they wrote, the rabbis will know. If you take a look at source number 13, I'll come back to 12 in a second. Source number 13, this was the rabbinic decree. Whenever you publish such books anew, you shall leave in place of any passage in which any of the deeds of Jesus of Nazareth are described a vacant space. And in that space, you shall print a circle like this. And they show you a circle, in case you didn't know what it looked like. For the rabbis and those who have learnt the omitted passages will know how to teach the youths in each case, while at the same time Christian scholars will be unable to base charges against us on such grounds. The other piece that I had there, where I skipped to number 12, was that it became popular to include disclaimers in works of Jewish law as well as the Talmud when lines referred to idolaters, and to say this doesn't refer to our neighbors who are wonderful people who observe the laws and who are great. I'm not kidding, like that's basically what you would see in the disclaimer. Or what you would find is that the Jews themselves would make sure to come up with words to refer to their Christian neighbors that a Jewish reader would know referred to them, but that they could still claim innocence on. So for example, yeah, but take a look at source number 12. Source number 12 is from Rabbi Yathiel Michal Epstein, author of a work of Jewish law called the Aruch HaShulchan, as I noted there, is published in early 20th century Lithuania. He's talking about the case of a Torah scroll written by a non-Jew or a Jew who doesn't believe, and he says, all of these Torah scrolls written by non-believers are disqualified by the Torah, but, he says, it's not idolatrous. The writer's intent, if they just aren't believers, the writer's intent is not for worship of the stars, by which he means Christianity primarily. He says, even an Egyptian, we do not say that his thought is for the stars. Even if it's written by an Egyptian, I don't think that what he's writing is for the stars. How many Egyptians do you think Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein met in early 20th century Lithuania? If you think you need one hand to count them on, I don't think you're correct. What he has done is he's used Egyptian. And any reader of this knows he doesn't mean Egyptian. Now, there might have been a particular reason to choose Egyptian. Someone pointed out to me last week in a class on a separate topic The word in Hebrew for Egyptian is? Mitzri. The word in Hebrew for a Christian is? Notzri. Quite similar, even the Nun and the Vav together that are the opening two letters, if you put them close enough together, can resemble the Mem from Mitzri. That may be why he chooses this. I can think of a couple of reasons, but it's very clearly a code that he's doing there. Finally,
in actual fact, how many Torahs would have been written by a Christian or not?
That's a really good question. It could be he's dealing with it as an academic question rather than something practical, but I don't know. It's a good question. There is a huge lasting impact from this on Judaism on so many different levels. In the year 553, Emperor Justinian forbade Jews from using anything other than a Greek or Latin translation of the Bible. You could use the Bible itself, or a Greek or Latin translation. That may have been what ended the use of the Targum or Tarjum, the Aramaic commentary to the biblical text during the public Torah reading. That could be what ended it in Ashkenazi communities, because it continued in Sephardic communities and Yemenite communities long after it stopped in the Ashkenazi ones. And that may have been a reason why. The prayer book, the Siddur, was changed as a result of this. The most famous attack on the Siddur due to censorship was probably in 1240 in France, that same time as the burning of the Talmud, and the attack on Kol Nidre. Have you heard of this? What does Kol Nidre do? What is Kol Nidre about?
It nullifies vows.
It nullifies vows. Right. What's it doing at the start of Yom Kippur?
You have to make a fresh start. You have to clean the slate.
Clean the slate for the year? Could be. You notice that along with Kol Nidre, traditionally, there's a line in which they declare, Al Da'at HaMakom Ve'Al Da'at HaKahal, within the mind, I suppose, is not a great one, with the knowledge of, it's probably better, with the knowledge of God and with the knowledge of the community, Anu Matirin Lehitpalel Im Ha'avar Yanim, we permit, using the same term that's used for permitting vows, for repealing a vow, we permit prayer with those who have sinned. What is that doing at the start of Yom Kippur? It is a declaration that all those who have been excommunicated, all those who were banned by the community during the year by force of a vow, are now readmitted to the community so that they can all pray together on Yom Kippur. That is what I understand that declaration to be about. Forgiveness is a funny thing. You can't legislate forgiveness. But the idea is that, yes, they're admitted back in with everybody else. And yes, at the start of Yom Kippur, there is this idea of getting rid of the vows that have been made and starting fresh, and the community starting fresh, but Christian authorities looked at that and said, you know what these Jews are trying to do? They're trying to get rid of their debts that they owe us. And they're declaring null and void all of their vows. And so, they tried to ban Kol Nidre. That actually continued in Italy, in Germany, and Reform actually removed it from the Machzor for that purpose. I don't know if that's all Reform now, but Reform in early Germany, early days of Reform in Germany, I should say, at the beginning of the 19th century, omitted Kol Nidre for that reason. Yes, Loretta.
But the wording for the vows is not the past vows. It's Yom Kippur Hazem, Yom Kippur Haba. It's the coming year that the vows. It's not really the past vows.
So that's actually quite a debate. Loretta is saying that the wording of Kol Nidre is about future vows, not past vows. That's actually subject to classic debate as to what the ability to repeal a vow is really about. Do you have the ability to repeal a vow made in the past, or can you simply make a commitment regarding vows in the future? But if I was a member of the church, either one would upset me, because I would say, so every year they are saying whatever commitments we make in the coming year are going to be void. It would bother them either way. But in fact, you will find both additions, and you will find additions that include both. In other words, if you were to open up an art scroll Siddur now, an art scroll Machzor, I should say, that's used in many Orthodox synagogues, you will find an addition that actually includes past and future vows. They have both. One of them may be in parentheses, I don't remember. But yes, either one would offend the church. There was a hand here? Okay. Yeah.
So does that mean that you said not to use the word forgive, but what would it mean, like, forgive any indiscretions that I might commit in the future?
No, it doesn't help with indiscretions. It's only a declaration that vows should not be binding.
So what is a vow? A vow is a promise.
Yeah, when a person would take on a fast and say they're going to fast on a particular day, a personal one, not the communal fasts, or a person would in a quarrel with somebody else and they would swear they're not going to help them with something or give them anything. That kind of vow is what we're talking about. Sure. The other one that I think is probably well known is the attack on Aleinu. Right? There's a line within Aleinu. I brought it here in source number 14. There's a line within the traditional text of Aleinu. Aleinu is a prayer which is recited usually, traditionally, at the end of each of the services. Shacharit Mincha Maariv, morning, afternoon, and evening. It's sort of a national anthem when you look at its meaning, where it speaks about the duty of the Jew to praise God in the very beginning of it, but to, looking at the broader text, describes the Jews as bowing before God, about God being wonderful because of what he has done, longing for a future time when the world will be a better place and when the world will be improved in the image of God. It carries within it many of the basic ideas of Judaism, and that's why it has the place it does. But one of the lines thanks God for making us Jewish, as opposed to being like them. And then it says, for they bow to worthlessness and emptiness and pray to a God who does not save. You might imagine that the church isn't happy with this line. At the end of 14th century in Germany, they want to edit it out. The truth of the matter is the line probably had nothing to do with Christianity. The line is a very old line. At the latest, it's 3rd century, and by tradition we're taught it is far earlier than that, before there are Christians. Nonetheless, they take it very personally. There was a convert by the name of Peter, had been named Pesach when he was Jewish, but then he became Peter, who said, and this is what I brought you here in number 14, you see the part I have in Hebrew? The word for emptiness is varik. Right? That's what you see there. Vav, Resh, Yud, Kuf. So for the mathematicians who are familiar with the Hebrew language, to calculate the gematria, the numerical value of these letters, the numerical value is 316, which happens to be the same as the numerical value of the name Yeshu, which is the Hebrew way to write Jesus. So they said, this is meant as a jab at them, that he is emptiness, that they're using this word in particular, which is silly. Again, because the text probably existed before Christianity existed, and because really we have better ways to insult people if we want. It's all in gematria. Who can even get it? Nonetheless, in Bologna in 1537, they actually decided, okay, we're just going to leave in the words Shehem Mishtachavim, for they bow, and omit the rest of the line. Others omitted the whole line, and frankly, down till today, I think it's safe to say that most prayer books in the Jewish world omit this line. Some have reinserted it in parentheses, as a sort of compromise to it. But it's subject to debate. Now, today it may be less popular for an entirely different reason, which is that today it's less popular to condemn the religions of others and to say, well, what they're doing is emptiness and what I'm doing is substantive. But that's part of a whole other discussion about how Jews and non-Jews get along beyond the scope of this session. There's much more to say, and the impact on Judaism, there's much more to describe. The loss of knowledge, the loss of manuscripts, but I'm seeing now that I've taken up almost the entire session today. I'm continuing from last week. Why didn't anybody stop me at some point and didn't say hello? I wasn't even paying attention to the time. I'm sorry. I don't have the ability to add another week, but we'll get through what we'll get through. Let's start talking about the second topic at any rate. And we'll get through what we need to get through. We'll be okay. The topic for the next week is publishing wars. The publishing wars of the 16th century. And my goal in this topic is for us to learn about the business side of early Jewish printing, to learn about the development of copyright and intellectual property rights within Jewish law. And unfortunately, we will see yet another instance of the public burning of the Talmud, this one from the 16th century. Take a look, please, at source number one on the new sheet. Okay, the sheet that says week two. From Marvin Heller, Further Studies in the Making of the Early Hebrew Book. On August 12, 1553, Pope Julius III, issued a papal bull ordering the confiscation and burning of the Babylonian and Jerusalem Talmuds. In a time of religious turmoil and repression in Europe, the Counter-Reformation, this particular decree represented the culmination of a dispute between two printers, neither of whom were Jewish, over competing editions of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah with the glosses of Rabbi Meir Katzenellenbogen of Padua. Did that make any sense? Did that make any sense to you? There was a fight between two non-Jewish printers about the printing of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, which is a work of law, with the glosses of Rabbi Meir Katzenellenbogen, and that led to the public burning of the Talmud by the Pope.
It was a business.
Strictly business, nothing personal. So the question is, what in the world are you talking about? That's the, I think, the general question we have to ask. What in the world happened? So, here we go. In the early days of the printing press, right, the Italian provinces were among the leaders in adopting the German technology of the printing press, often actually having Germans come in to set up and run the presses. The researcher by the name of Gideon Borsa has done research, and he has established that between the years of 1465 and 1500, printing presses were established in 77 Italian cities and towns. Right? 35 years and the early going of the printing press, and it just ballooned in Italy. Now, when I say Italy, that's sort of an anachronism, because it wasn't Italy then. You had different provinces that we can call the Italian provinces, because where they were would, you know, another few centuries later become Italy. But at that stage, there are different provinces, and in Venice, which is where this action is going to take place, the Venetian Senate is in control of the trades, and they regulate printing. Now, as we already learned last week, Jewish presses were taken out of the hands of Jews in the middle of the 16th century. Among those presses that are established in Italy in the early going, before it's taken out of the hands of Jews, you have Hebrew language presses. They're actually among the earliest in Italy. The first Hebrew book printed in Italy with a publishing date of which we have a record was produced in the year 1475. It is the commentary of Rashi on the biblical text, on Chumash. 1475, so we were early adopters. Most of the 15th century Hebrew printers were Jewish, led by the Sansino family, which I mentioned before. They printed the Talmud in its expurgated version. They published books of Jewish law. They published liturgy, Siddur, Machzor. They published non-Hebrew books also. By the year 1500, about 200 Hebrew volumes have already been printed. Readers include not just Jews, but also Christians who wanted to read Hebrew. There were Christian publishers as well. Perhaps the most famous, I think he is the most famous, would be Daniel Bamberg. Daniel Bamberg was originally from Antwerp, but he moved to Italy. And he published books with high-quality craftsmanship, beautiful typographical arrangement, really setting the standard for Hebrew printing. He published the first edition of what is, without a doubt, the most popular Hebrew edition of Scripture, of Chumash. Not really Tanakh, but the most popular Hebrew edition of Chumash, called Mikraot Gedolot. Mikraot Gedolot has been published over and over and over again, with some switching of the commentaries over the centuries. But it begins with Daniel Bamberg, this Christian fellow, working with Jewish advisors, selecting a cross-section of Jewish commentaries to up until his day, and publishing the Chumash with it. It becomes wildly popular, because no longer do I need a separate text. Biblical text. Rashi on the text. Nachmanides on the text. This one on the text. That one, I've got it all in one volume. All of the commentaries are together on the same page as the biblical text itself. So I can read the text at the top and then jump down here to see this commentary, down here to see that commentary. It's very useful, and that's Bamberg's work. But, as we've said, in 1547, Jews are banned from running printing presses. And so Christian printers take over the field. They hire Jews, or they hire Jews who have converted to Christianity to produce content. Which brings us to this major publishing war, which I'm going to introduce, but then we're going to have to come back to next time. It begins with a fellow by the name of Marc Antonio Giustiniani, not a Jewish fellow. Marc Antonio establishes the Hebrew press in Venice in the year 1545. He's from a family of Venetian noblemen. And he emerges as a powerful cutthroat rival to Bamberg, who already is quite old at this point. He produces an advertisement that he spreads around the community, saying, I'm going to publish everything from the Talmud to more modern writings in new printing with beautiful print and paper, and it's going to cost less than the existing editions being published by Daniel Bamberg. He hires away Bamberg's editors. He hires, perhaps more importantly, the people who compose the type. Because when you hire them, you have the potential to actually get the type itself that they had set. And that is what ends up happening. And Giustiniani doesn't really care about producing fine quality stuff. He's a businessman. And what he's trying to do is to undercut Bamberg. So he does not produce high quality printings at all. He does add value by putting in indices in the text, or adding translations, illuminated manuscripts sometimes. And he copies Bamberg's work. And what he does is, when Bamberg produces a text, he either produces the same exact text, or something that is going to be in immediate competition with Bamberg's text. So sometimes it's actually the same exact thing, Midrash Rabbah, works of grammar, and sometimes it's just something that's going to compete. So in 1546, Bamberg publishes a work of Jewish law called the Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, which is a collection of the commandments in the Torah. Giustiniani publishes the work called the Kolbo, which is of the same variety. Bamberg publishes Shibole Halekit, which has Jewish customs and prayers. Giustiniani publishes a work called the Avudraham, which has commentary to the Siddur and to Jewish liturgy in general. Bamberg in 1546 publishes a work going back to the Gaonim, the 7th to 10th period, 7th to 10th century period, called the Shehiltot. Giustiniani publishes another work called Halachot Gedolot from the same period a year later in 1548. And the end result is that Giustiniani succeeds in putting Bamberg out of business 1548-1549 and enjoys a de facto monopoly on Jewish printing at that time in Venice. That's Giustiniani. Next will come the actual publishing war, but that we'll have to continue with, God willing, next week.
Rabbi showed that the Jews were really readers.
Oh, yeah. It was worthwhile for someone to do this.